listen in while I have a conversation with my online horsemanship proteges about the relationship between struggle and success, pressure and joy. We often get the feeling that just because something is difficult, that we shouldn't be doing it, when in fact, we need to find that sweet spot for pressure. I hope you find it helpful.
All right, we got a few of you here. I'll go ahead and get started. Hi, Charlie. Good morning. All right, guys. It's officially 9 o'clock. So we'll get going. I've actually done a little bit of like more, oftentimes it's off the cuff when I'm talking to you guys. It's just like a topic that I can just like talk about. And this is one too, but I actually made a bunch of bullet point notes and it's a lot. There's a lot to cover. So we're gonna get into it pretty straight away. But the biggest thing is to understand that not the biggest thing, but something I want you to consider, right, is that if and you need notes, take them, because my notes are sort of not that useful. Okay, so if you need notes, take them, and you know, I'll remind you that I'll post the recording so you can listen back to it anytime you want to rewrite things down, if you need, you know, to reference written things. Okay, the good news is that it has been sunny and above freezing here during the day. It's still cold at night, you know, below freezing at night. But there's a ton of snow melt, which is good in that, like, it's leading toward better days. But right now, it's just a sloppy mess. Like I can see my arena, which I haven't been able to see my arena in a few weeks, right? It's just been covered in snow, probably like 2 feet of snow. Which is new. That's the most snowfall we've gotten here since we've lived here. And in February, we're coming up on our 4th year. Like that'll be our 4-year anniversary of being here. I'm gonna tell you guys, I'm gonna rename my place. It's a funny thing. A lot of people avoid sort of changing something if they don't like it, and I don't do that. Like if I don't like it, I just change it. I don't know why I'm comfortable with that, and others are not, but I'm 100% comfortable with that. So my place is no longer going to be called the Double S. It felt mildly, you know, like a good fit of a name for our place, but it never felt like super good down to my bones. Like it didn't like encompass all that we are. It's a fun little like inside joke between Shane and I, because we're both Smiths, right? My Smith is both my maiden name and my married name. That's why we called it the Double S. But you know, the whole thing of it, like being an inside joke, is only mildly satisfying. So instead, I'm going to call it Whispering Woods. All right. Because the whole thing about my love here is about the trees. So it's Whispering Woods, or maybe Whispering Woods Haven. We're going to call it Whispering Woods. So if you see me change the name of it, like on social media pages and stuff, that's why. I'm a fickle little creature and I don't mind changing the name. Whispering Woods, I think is going to stick. Yeah, I think it's going to stick. I really like it. With the snow melt, hopefully that will include then Vanna and I being able to get back to doing some stuff, and me being able to continue to add video support to the task lists on our Facebook page. Okay. But for now, we're all just fat and sassy. Not me though. I'm working out. I'm getting strong. I'm strong and flexible. but that ties into what we're going to talk about this week. I think that I would be bold enough to say that the single most important component of finding joy and satisfaction in our horsemanship journey is understanding that just because there is discomfort or pressure or a feeling of failure, doesn't mean that you are a failure, right? Or that there isn't going to be joy, or that there's no hope in sight, that what you're doing is wrong, right? It just means that there's learning to be had, right? Any kind of discomfort is a marker that says there's a missing ingredient here, right? There's a piece missing. And so this week's conversation is about identifying pressure, right? Like what is pressure? What is discomfort? What constitutes you know, that discomfort, and how can I turn those feelings into success, right? Into feelings of joy. And, you know, like it was for a reason, that it had a purpose, and, that purpose will lead to, more enticing struggles, right? Like the struggle I have with Gina is a base struggle. It feels like a fundamental struggle, which is extra frustrating to me, right? That the fundamental struggle is her lack of confidence, right? That everything scares the shit out of her. And everything I've done up till now has only mildly reshaped it, right? That is a hard one for me to swallow, but I'm getting better at it. Whereas the struggle with Vanna is, you know, impulsion. That's a way better struggle than I'm afraid if I sit on you too long, I might die. You know, like when you first rides on, or you ride a horse like Gina, the pain, the discomfort, the pressure is, I feel unsafe. That's a real hard one. That's not fun. That's really challenging. Also, meet my new plant. Isn't he beautiful? That's a form of snake plant, and they're supposed to be extra good at purifying the air. I have a really huge one here next to my desk over there. Look at it. Okay. Sorry. Sparkly, shiny. I got distracted because I noticed it in the background. All right. So safety concerns are a much more impactful discomfort than results, you know, concerns, right? Like impulsion, flexion, maneuvers, right? I can't wait for the day that our discomfort is centered around, why won't she change leads? Like, that'd be awesome, right? That'd be an amazing struggle to be embracing right now versus the one I'm embracing with Gina, which is, you know, why does it feel like every time I sit on you, I might die? That's unpleasant. That's more unpleasant than, you know, why won't these flying lead changes happen? So the first part of our top talk here this morning is going to be about identifying a struggle as a force that can either be motivating or debilitating, and whether which one it is for you is a decision you made, right? That it's not a matter of circumstances that are beyond your influence, right? Whether or not you decide that the struggle you are in right now is, you know, soul crushing or motivating is up to you. You have to decide. So the thing that, you know, with Gina is, it could very easily be soul crushing, right? She's been with me for like 5 or 6 years now. She's so talented, so beautiful. I would love to be doing Englishy things with her and not cult start things, right? Even if the Englishy things were just like 20 meter circles at the walk, trot, and canter, that'd be so freaking awesome. But it isn't. That's not where we're at. And if I resist that, then I'm going to cause myself unnecessary pain that doesn't lead to any kind of success. If I accept it and reframe my mindset, right? I can do that. That is within my power, right? I can reshape how I look at it. That doesn't mean I can do it instantly, right? That is a behavior, a mindset that I have to train in myself with her. And it's starting to work. It's taken me a year, right? It's been almost a year. It's probably like 8 months, maybe eight, I don't know, half a year. So it's been months and months, right? That I was like, I'm done struggling with this right now. She and I just have been on a break from arena stuff. And what I've done in those months is take care of her basic needs, right? You know, that requires some training. Trimming her feet had been a big deal. And now that's not a big deal anymore. So that's really awesome. You know, feed time stuff can be a big deal for her. She still hates being in a stall, stuff like that. So there's been some training happening, but more than that, what I've focused on over these last months is, you are so cool, and I'm just glad to have you in my string, right? You don't owe me shit, right? You don't owe me a thing. That my love for you is not performance based, right? I fell in love with you the minute I met you. And she pulls on a core need for me, and the core need for me, the reason I love her so much, is that she needs me, right? She needs me, not, you know, some Olympic rider or somebody who could probably get her to perform bigger things. She needs me. She needs someone who's going to accept her for who she is, love her no matter what, not, you know, push her beyond, you know, an appropriate amount of discomfort so that she has to defend herself, things like that. She needs me. I love that about her. Maxie does not need me. I could hand her over to any one of you and she'd cope. She'd be fine. She'd get along just fine. You know, she'd probably argue with you, but she'd manage. She wouldn't be, you know, devastated. Shane is constantly trying to get me to rehome Gina. He thinks that, you know, it's a wasted position in my string because I'm not able to ride her and stuff like that. And he knows I love this filly that my friend Brandy has. And, you know, you could have the filly if you didn't have Gina, blah, blah, blah. I can't do it, right? My conscience won't let me. She needs me. That kind of transition would be devastating to her. So she, you know, that's what I mean about reframing the disappointment. Am I still disappointed and frustrated that I can't ride her? Yes. Okay. You know, like that, I'm not pretending it's good when it's not, right? I'm not, you know, there's no incongruence in how I feel about it, right? I acknowledge that I'm disappointed that I can't ride her regularly, right? Consistently, the way I wish I was riding her by now. Does that mean I don't still love her? No. Does that mean she still doesn't have value to me? No, of course not. You know, she's a beautiful, sweet, kind, loving, gentle energy, and she needs me, right? So, you know, I'm lucky in that I have other horses to meet those needs, right? If she was my only horse, it'd be a lot harder for me to accept where we're at and just, you know, keep trying and not put any pressure on myself or her to do any better than what we are doing. But because my needs are getting met by my other horses, you know, I can just go, you know what, there's no harm in me to just keep trying, right? I'm not giving up on her. I'm not going to stop trying to progress with her and get to where we could ride. But I'm just going to be less worried about whether or not we make progress or not, right? I love her. She's here no matter what. End of story, right? That's a decision I made, not the result of an external circumstance. It is a decision I've had to train myself to be okay with over months, right? It's not any dissimilar to the fitness journey I've been on. It's only been a month, maybe 6 weeks, 4 weeks. I don't know. How long have I been going to the gym? I don't know. 4 weeks, maybe. And I'm starting to just now feel a little bit stronger. Like I had class yesterday and my muscles are a little bit sore today, but not so sore that I can't walk up and down the stairs. Where the first classes, I was like, holy smokes, I am debilitated, right? my quads in that first class, something about bar classes, my friends. You think ballerinas are dainty little boogers? No, that was hard. You know, I'm starting to feel stronger because I'm, you know, repeating. It's a training process. It's not just like today I decided that I wanted to be stronger and more flexible. Ta-da, just because I decided today is done. I have to train it. Okay. So that's what I want to really impress upon you is how you feel about a situation is a trainable thing, right? That I don't mean affirmations. Okay. I think oftentimes with affirmations that can lead to toxic positivity, where there's an incongruence between your words and how you actually feel about something, right? The process of me learning to be okay with Gina has been about acknowledging that it sucks, acknowledging and admitting that I'm disappointed, and then finding a way to just be okay with that. All right. It's not about positive affirmations. Okay. It's just about deciding what's important to me and putting my energy into things that I can influence rather than, you know, putting my energy into things I have no influence on. Right. So there you go. Real quick. Cindy says, I hear you on the fear soul crushing thing. I feel like I live in two worlds. One where everyone at the show thinks I have a perfect horse and the one where I dread the bucking and feel like a failure and I can't get past it. Yeah. You dancers do have legs of steel, Bonnie. So I'm going to help you with that, Cindy. Okay. So the first thing is we have to get good at, when it comes to ourselves and horse training, at being able to identify pressure, right? And really, to me, pressure is just any time there's any feeling of discomfort, whether it's mild, moderate, or extreme. And oftentimes with ourselves and with horses, the whole concept of the ability to do less sooner is being able to identify the smaller, the milder moments where there is discomfort, and understand that discomfort and pressure, when it comes to training, whether it's training your own brain or training horses, is synonymous. It's the same thing, all right? And that anytime a discomfort or pressure shows up, especially if it's circumstantial and not pressure that you know, intended, it's trying to tell you something, right? There's some message in it about something you desire not being fully at your fingertips just yet, okay? Now, with horses specifically, let's talk about different ways horses can perceive pressure, both from us and from the environment. Of course, there is physical pressure. That's what we use to teach them about what our language is, right? That there's a, you want to call it, you know, tagging them or whacking them, you know, whatever it is, acknowledging that we use physical pressure, right? Physical discomfort to teach them where to find harmony. There is no physical discomfort in harmony, all right? Harmony feels good. Comfort is the goal, right? So understand, we got to get good at identifying what is supposed to be comfortable and what is supposed to be uncomfortable. Comfortable for horses is subtle. Whatever we can do to communicate our desires to them, to initiate the dance, needs to be subtle, right? Not secretive, not sneaky, not unclear, just subtle, all right? So wiggling my finger is more subtle than wiggling my rope, right, to get my horse to back up. So it has a better chance of being comfortable for them to respond to that cue, all right? The less subtle my communication is, the more sort of sloppy my communication is, the more I'm going to dull my horse and the more pressure I'm going to need in order to get shit done. Right? So if you're having to whack the crap out of your horse, it's because your communication isn't subtle. Your horse doesn't see enough comfort in the doing of the thing. So you have to use mild to moderate amount of pressure just to make it happen versus using pressure to get them to be responsive. Okay. Physical pressure should teach our horses to be light. But in order for them to be light, we have to offer subtle, right? In order for it to be reinforcing and a experience that leads to harmony, you need to be subtle. They need to be responsive. All right. Another way that horses feel pressure is through the manipulation of our and their personal space, right? Spatial pressure is a thing. A lot of times, a really common one that this comes up with is, how close are you to the fence when you're asking your horse to do something, whether it's pass between you and the fence or back up, things like that. Like, how close are you to a barrier? That's spatial pressure. It's going to make them uncomfortable and has the potential to influence whether or not achieving the task is a good thing for them, right? It will put pressure on the situation. Spatial, you know, so first physical pressure, now spatial pressure. That, you know, for Gina, spatial pressure is a big thing, right? She feels spatial pressure in my shed. My shed is 60 feet long and open to the south, right? It's huge. That is it. That's a huge opening. And she still feels that it's potentially a trap, right? So anytime your horse feels like it might be a trap, that is spatial pressure. Putting your horse into vertical flexion, spatial pressure. That's what that video that I posted last year where she had that pretty big spook, it was because I asked her to tuck her nose. She got claustrophobic in that shape, right? And it made her uncomfortable enough that some small stimulus, I don't even, a squirrel farted, I don't know, right? caused, it was just too much, pushed her over the edge for just a second. We had a quick little spook there, right? But that happened because of the spatial pressure she felt of the vertical flexion. Okay. Another potential source of pressure is your tone, right? Whether it's the tone from your voice or your facial expressions, right? The tone of your body language even can either put pressure on them or, you know, provide a space where harmony is possible. So, for example, right, many of us are afflicted with a condition called resting bitch face. I know how very uncomfortable my thinking face makes a lot of people, all right, and my horses, right? That's a tone that bothers them. It's a tonal pressure. My horses are also bothered by the tone of my voice. Even, you know, I've seen Pat make big stinks about you can't growl at your horse and have that be a correction for them. I'd beg to differ. I don't know that I growl at my horses, but what I have done is growled at my dog and had that bother my horses, right? And it was the tone of my voice, right? The grumpy sound of my voice. She's at my feet, so I'm not going to say her name because she's being good. But like, that's why she's no longer allowed to be loose when at feed time, right? Because it's a big deal to me that feed time is a peaceful, easy, smooth, slow process, that nobody gets riled or rushy or rammy at feed time. And I was constantly having to growl at my dog because her instincts would kick up, right? She'd want to go in and nip at their heels. And they actually didn't really respond that much to her nipping at them. They would get worried when I'd growl at the dog, right? So I do think that horses are affected by tone of voice, right? That you can put pressure on them via your tone of voice, right? So tone is another form of pressure. The tone of your voice, the tone of your expression, the tone of your body language. It's also another reason why I don't use the Schwiegermutter look for yielding my horse with my body anymore. Because that's not the tone I want those yields to have, right? I want it to have a pleasing feeling to them when they're responsive to me. So understand that the Schwiegermutter look is pressure. And if I need it, I will use it. But it's not the way I communicate my request to back up or yield the hindquarters, yield the forequarters, that sort of thing. Okay. Your tone. Your equipment can have its own pressure, right? Whether it's your stick, your bit, your spurs, right? Equipment has its own pressure. And we need to know that. Like when I first started working with Kaya, the stick had pressure that I didn't want it to have, right? I had to reprogram her, right? Retrain her to understand that the stick isn't pressure in and of itself, right? That the way I use the stick might be pressure, but the stick itself isn't pressure. The same thing can be said for spurs. I'm both excited and dreading the day I put the saddle on her for the first time, because she's likely to perceive that as pressure. And so I have to understand that the saddle has its own pressure in it. And whether or not I want it to have pressure or not, then that's going to determine what I do with it next, right? Equipment has pressure depending on the situation, all right? The repetition has pressure, guys. Repetition. If your horse does what you ask him to do and you keep asking them to do it, that puts pressure back in it, right? So if they do the thing, they do the spin, they do they put their feet on the pedestal, they do the jump, they do the flying lead change, and you just keep asking for it, it goes from being pleasing to having pressure in it. They just get into a spot where they're like, I thought I did the right thing, but you keep asking me to do it. So maybe it wasn't the right thing. And then they get anxious because they start to feel confused about the goal. And now repetition is the source of pressure, right? So you got to avoid being greedy. Yeah, Bonnie, right? It's hard, right? Because as soon as something feels fun, like it's going good, you go, oh, that was great. Do it again. But we need to understand that repetition is its own kind of pressure, all right? Sometimes you can use that as a training aid, right? So a common one is change of direction, right? That for some reason, when you do the slingshot change of direction, that gets some horses riled up. It gets a lot of horses, their blood up, all right? That doesn't have to be a bad thing, right? I use it on purpose with Maxie to get her excited, where Vanna, I'd rather she not do that. She's like, it's just, I don't like that vibe out of her. It's not that hard to get energy out of her. So I'll use repetition until it simmers down, right? So it's not that repetition's a bad thing. You got to decide whether you want to turn the volume up on a behavior or turn the volume down. And, you know, whether or not repetition will help or hinder that. Okay. So repetition. The timing of your request can either put pressure in the request or not, right? If you ask for a foot that's not available because of where your horse's weight is at the time, then no matter whether they say yes or no, or get, you know, get to the request, if their foot isn't available, there's pressure in their response to you, because they're, it's not, you've asked them a question that they're going to have to say in a minute to. And if your horses are like mine and they know that I don't like in a minute, right, that's not acceptable to me, they're going to feel anxious about that. So, you know, part of my responsibility then is to make sure that I don't ask for feet that aren't available to me, because that's going to put emotional pressure in their response to me. Like, oh, I want to do it for you, but I can't because my weight's in the wrong place. Okay. So the timing of your cue can either make it easy for them to say yes, or make it hard for them to say yes. And if you make it hard for them to say yes, then timing can equal pressure. Okay. Good shit, man. My brain, I'm on it today. I feel good. All right. Another important aspect, right, is how long do you hold the pressure, right? The duration of the pressure, the intensity of the pressure, and the timing of your release. All, you know, that all to me all kind of boils down into the same thing, right? That the application and release of pressure has the potential to lead to harmony or to lead to more stress, right? If you apply intense pressure too quickly, you're going to pop them right into the wilderness and they're going to get defensive. If you don't apply enough pressure, right, and that they're not, you don't get them outside of their comfort zone and into the window of trainability, there won't be any learning, right? Or if you apply the right amount of pressure but don't release it at the right time, it won't make sense and it'll lead to stress, right? So the timing, duration, and release of pressure either will help your horse make sense of pressure or cause your horse to feel stressful about pressure. And one way they show stress about pressure is to shut down, all right? So just because your horse seems quiet doesn't mean that they've made sense of pressure. It just means they've learned to tune it out. It can mean that. It doesn't have to mean that. The intensity of the pressure, the duration of the pressure, and the release of the pressure will decide whether or not pressure equals success or does pressure equal stress. Okay. Super important. Super duper important. Okay. All right. Another one is consistency in your cue. All right. A really common one is that when I ask my horse to go sideways and I'm on the ground, my arms form an L shape, right? That the hand closest to their nose is pointed at the nose, and the hand along the side there is out to the side at a 90 degree angle. That cue needs to be the same every time. If I keep changing it, even just a little, then my horse is going to wonder if it's the same thing, and it's going to cause them to feel confused, and confusion equals stress, right? But if I can keep my cues the same, the word for the behavior the same every time, that when I suck straight back, that means get ready for a slingshot change of direction. When I suck back in a curve, that means bring your nose to me and pay attention to the rest of the stuff I'm doing, because I might ask you to change direction. I might ask you to come to me, right? That has to be consistent so that they can prepare themselves for what's likely to happen next, versus if I keep changing the language, it's going to cause confusion and that's going to cause stress. Okay. Of course, the environment can add pressure to any given, conversation. Vanna is a classic example of a horse who's really comfortable in natural environments, right? Trail riding, outdoor arenas feel very comfortable to her. Indoor arenas is a different environment and she feels pressure in there, right? It's a different situation for her in that environment. I have to work a little harder on her confidence. You know, where a lot of horses are the opposite. I think Gina is the opposite. I haven't had a chance to ride her a lot in indoor arenas, but the couple of times that I have, she's actually way better. She's way better in an indoor than an outdoor. So, you know, understanding that the environment can be putting pressure on your horse. And here's the thing about pressure, right, guys? There's a sweet spot, and we think we know where the sweet spot is. There's a sweet spot where pressure can lead to a success, or if you get beyond it, then the pressure will lead to stress, right? So there's if the environment is adding pressure to your horse, and then you add pressure to try to teach them something, they're more likely to pop into the wilderness. You know, you have to take into account the pressure that they might be feeling due to environmental factors. Okay. The environment is a source of stress. And that's it. Okay, that's the all the ways I can think of that horses potentially perceive stress. Okay. Now let's talk about what leads to success or pressure becoming success versus pressure becoming stress. Okay. The goal is to understand what motivates behavior, right? There are two, you know, terms in the world of behavior modification that can help clarify this concept, right? There's primary reinforcers and then there's secondary reinforcers. I wanted to be very studious for you on this, and I'm going to give you an official definition of a primary reinforcer. All right. A primary reinforcer is a stimulus or reward that inherently satisfies a biological need and doesn't require prior learning or association to become reinforcing. These are typically things like food, water, companionship, or relief from pressure or comfort, right? Comfort is a primary reinforcer. You don't have to train your horse to appreciate comfort. They are born appreciating comfort, same as us, right? In the context of horsemanship, the desire for a primary reinforcer can be a form of pressure. The desire for a primary reinforcer can be a form of pressure. So all those people out here who think that just because they use positive reinforcement means that they're not using pressure, it's a load of hooey, right? The desire for the food is pressure. It's mental and emotional pressure. What do I got to do to shake you down for that treat? Okay. And here I want to read another little piece here from some of the research I did for you. Over-reliance on these rewards can lead to increased pressure on the horse, especially if the trainer consistently uses them as the sole motivator. A horse constantly seeking a primary rate reinforcer may become anxious or overly focused on the reward, potentially affecting the overall responsiveness, right? So instead of thinking about the dance, right? Instead of having a conversation with them, all they can think about is where's the cookie? Where's the cookie? Where's the cookie? Where's the cookie? Right? That's how we turn them into cookie monsters. So I'm not saying don't use cookies. I always have cookies in my back pocket. I'm saying don't use only cookies, right? That the to me, the most effective form of training is one that's a balance of all the possibilities, right? Like I want to use all the options so that I have lots of arrows in my quiver, right? Okay. So the big thing about understanding the language here, though, is understanding the difference between a reward and a reinforcer. A reward is something that I add to that it's a payment, right? So food is a reward, right? Comfort is a reinforcer. Water has the potential to be either. I'm doing so much talking. I should have known better to not have a glass of water up here. So just as a like it can be a point of contention amongst the sort of the zealots in the behavior world that you use the right lingo. And it can be a reason for us as a genre of horse trainers to lose credibility in that you know facet of people if we don't use the right words, right? So reinforcer shapes behavior, but it's not something I added. It's just available. Where reward is it, a reward really only applies to treats, right? That's it. Everything else is a reinforcer. Okay. My very Okay. Now, let's talk about some potential pitfalls here. All right. Biggest thing, and we talked about it in the beginning, is to understand that discomfort, pressure, any sort of, you know, even what you might categorize as a negative emotion, doesn't have to be the enemy. It can be a means to train behavior. It depends on whether or not we understand our horse's limits, right? We need to know what it takes for our horses to be in their comfort zone at all times, right? No matter what the situation is, I need to know where it is the comfort zone. How do I access the comfort zone in this situation? And so the most challenging situations are the ones where you can't find the comfort zone. No matter what you do, you can't get your horse to reset. There's no reset available to you. Trail rides are a really, really common one, right? That you know, you've gotten 2 miles down the trail. Something happens, it pops your horse into the wilderness. No matter what you do, you can't get them back into their comfort zone. So, you know, the biggest thing for me on that one is people are too quick or too complacent about going trail riding alone. Or if they go trail riding with a group, you choose poorly, right? The people you go with on a trail ride will have a huge influence on whether or not you can access your horse's comfort zone. You know, depending on the horse you have. I talk about it all the time that Maxie is the comfort zone. If I'm going to take students trail riding, although I think I could do it with Vanna now. I have done it with Vanna. She's getting really good. She loves trail riding. She's good. But Maxie carries with her a bubble of confidence no matter where she goes. I'm assuming it's because she's the matriarch in my herd, and that's her job is to keep everybody chill unless it's necessary to do otherwise, and for her it's never necessary to do otherwise. So you know, she is the source of comfort zone, and I've used her over the years to be the source of the comfort zone for training my young horses, right? I did a lot of ponying Satori with Maxie. I relied on Maxie's credibility with Satori to keep Satori calm. Right. And I've done the same thing with Kaya and Vanna, right? And I did the same thing with Vanna and Gina, right? That Vanna became the source of comfort. You know, little by little each day, I'm recognizing that Vanna's becoming the matriarch, which is not a bad thing. She's going to be a perfectly acceptable matriarch in my string. It's just sad to see Maxie like slip. You know, she's o older now and that's bugging me. I don't want her to be older. Stop it. Did you guys see that Lalonde's mare Adame? I don't know how to say her name, but she passed. She, you know, and she's not too much older than Maxie, and but had, you know, a real similar story, like her levels horse that, you know, gave her notability and credibility in the community and stuff like that. I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry. That sucks. She's 27. Maxie's 23 this year. So, oh, 4 years is not enough. Anyway. So you got to know where the comfort zone is, how to access it, what does it take? You know, it's got to be some kind of retreat. And, you know, so on a trail ride, that might be back to the trailer. And a lot of people aren't willing to do that, right? I'm 2 miles out. I don't want to turn back on this loop that's a, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 mile trail. And so they'll just keep barging ahead. And instead of being able to turn that source of pressure that's into success, it causes pressure to equal stress, right? So, you got to find that sweet spot in there that I call the window of trainability, right? Like how much pressure is useful versus how much pressure leads to coping mechanisms, right? If you're popping your horse into the wilderness, you can still get them to do stuff, right? It bugs the crap out of me when people say they're not trainable when they're panicked. That is not true. They are trainable. They're training how to be a better prey animal, right? You're reinforcing prey animal behavior. And those behaviors are going to be coping mechanisms. So excessive pressure leads to coping mechanisms, both in horses and humans, by the way. So putting ourselves in positions of excessive pressure with no means of accessing our comfort zone will be a way for you to develop coping mechanisms. That might be shut down. That might be explosion. That might be, you know, for me, it's grumpy, right? That if I'm pushed beyond my limits of, you know, trainability, I'm beyond the window of trainability into the wilderness. It takes very little for me to snap at somebody. That's the cue that my brain goes, oh, you're outside of the window of trainability. You're going to bite their head off. For others, that might just mean complete shutdown. It might mean, you know, like a tummy issue. There's all kinds of signs that you're in the wilderness, but you have to acknowledge it for yourself, right? So it's important to understand that, because with our horses, it's real easy for us to shoulda, woulda, coulda on ourselves. And I'm the same as you guys, right? I have gone through a process of shooting on myself about Gina, right? Like I'm supposed to be this, you know, credible international clinician, and I can't get this horse relaxed, confident, right? And in doing so, it'd be really easy for me to push myself beyond the window of trainability, put myself into the wilderness through you know, internal pressure and expectations, and then do the same to my horse and then get myself hurt, right? I think a lot of times where something goes horribly wrong, right, with our horses, it's because we ourselves first got pushed into the wilderness. And when predators get pushed into the wilderness, their focus gets very narrow. Our focus gets very narrow because we're direct line thinkers. So we lose our ability to perceive beyond like what's directly in front of us. So then something in the periphery happens and the fit hits the sham, right? Where horses are the opposite, right? When they get pushed into the wilderness, their perceptions get wide, right? So every little thing in their environment has the potential to be, you know, life ending. Either way, being in the wilderness is only going to lead to the best you can hope for is a coping mechanism. The worst that's going to happen is, you know, injury, bad stuff happens in the wilderness. So you got to avoid over exposure to pressure. You know, pressure is a tool, but it's not the tool. And it needs to be used judiciously, both for horses and for ourselves, right? And if we learn to do that effectively, that will lead to us learning to trust each other, right? Well, one of the things that is difficult for Gina and I is to trust one another. Part of the journey for us is I am having to pay for the sins of those who came before me, right? She has repeatedly been pushed into the wilderness by bipeds and, you know, put in situations that she felt were beyond her skill set. And then she did things that she felt were necessary for the time, and it worked, right? The people who were training her weren't bad people. They weren't, you know, tying her head down or, you know, snubbing her up to a post or anything like that. They just wanted her to canter. That was more than she could handle. She would explode, unload her rider, and get out of that situation by, you know, doing prey animal things, right? The extreme pressure, the way she got rid of the extreme pressure was by unloading the rider. Then that worked enough times that it became her go-to tool when it felt like it was too much pressure. So both me knowing that pops me into the wilderness now, and she's had rehearsal on that. So us learning to trust each other is a big deal, right? It's a lengthy process. I do not trust her when I'm on her. My nerves are on edge. And so I have to acknowledge that in myself, because I know then I'm less likely to apply pressure judiciously when I am in the wilderness. I'm more likely to do shit that's going to get me in trouble. So I am more than ready to get down. And the whole time I'm telling myself, you don't have to do anything you don't want to do. There's no reason for you to stay on. There's no reason for you to get on. It's not a big deal. Like, it, well, I shouldn't say it's not a big deal. It is a big deal, but I still don't have to do anything I don't want to do. All right. You have to know where your limits are and where their limits are, and avoid the overuse of pressure, right? Avoid pushing them into the wilderness and yourselves in order to build trust, right? In order for pressure to be a positive thing, there has to be an element of trust. In humans, the trust might just be that we trust ourselves, right? That we trust ourselves to make good choices and come up with a plan and be able to, you know, turn this stress into success. Horses need to learn to trust us and our suggestions, our ideas. They need to trust our leadership, trust our plan making skills. In order for that to happen, we need to be stable and steady in our emotions. We need to be reliable. We need to be observant. We need to be empathetic. We need to be confident, right? We talked about this in another Zoom, so I'm not going to go into that a lot, but it is important to understand that trust is a major component to whether or not you can convince your horse that pressure is information versus pressure is something to defend themselves from. If they don't trust you, they will not allow you to convince them that pressure can lead to is information. Okay. Let's see. Another important part of having pressure become success is we have to be progressive, right? And understand that, you know, bashing your head against the same wall over and over again with zero progress, or even with it, you know, regressing, is not useful, right? You got to know how much repetition is enough before you go, okay, this isn't working. I need more ideas. I need a different strategy. I need more support. I need to try something else, whatever it is, right? So if the learning is progressive, that also builds trust. And as it progresses, then horses learn that pressure isn't the enemy, right? That it's just information and it can help them feel successful. Where, okay, you have a question, Dana? Oh, okay. All right. Thanks for being here. See ya. Bye. So the biggest thing around that is progress, though, can come in tiny increments, right? It doesn't have to be huge leaps each time you're in the arena or each time you give something a go. If you try something and you eliminate that strategy as the right one for that particular situation, that's progress, right? It doesn't have to be, you know, like, yay, it's happening. It just means, okay, that didn't work. Like with Vanna in the cantering, I tried a lot of stuff. I tried adjusting the noseband on her cradle. I tried different bridles. I tried changing the shims in my saddle. I tried different saddles. None of that worked. I wanted it to be equipment so bad, but it was not equipment. It was, training. But, the main thing is to keep experimenting, right? And be progressive in your experiments. Fail forward, right? Failure isn't the enemy unless you're not learning from it. Failure is a good thing, right? Every time something fails, that, you know, you can check that off the list of options, right? It's not a bad thing. It's not a fun thing. I'm not like, you know, going out hoping I fail today, but as long as I learn from it, then it's a useful thing, right? It's still progressive. Okay. So, be progressive, fail forward, get good at measuring progress in tiny little increments, and understand that eliminating options is progress. Okay. All right. The two more things, okay, before I stop talking. It's really important component to this process is mindfulness, right? And that's a difficult component to describe. And so instead, I'm going to give you a scenario. Yesterday, none of you have been here. Hey, the end of our gravel road, that intersection onto the paved road is not nice. It's at the top of a hill and around a bit of a corner. So it's terrifying. I hate it. You know, so there's a, like that split second where either you got to commit that you're going out or wait a little bit longer. Like in the summertime, it's great because I just roll the windows down and then I try to listen to see if there's traffic coming. But when it's freezing cold out and you don't want to put the windows down, then you got to hope that you made a good choice. And yesterday I made a questionable choice, right? I pulled out and there was a guy coming up and he had to slow down because of the timing of when I pulled out, which, you know, whatever. But he gave me the finger the whole time he went by because I inconvenienced him by, you know, him he had to slow down because I pulled out. You know, I just didn't see it. Like I looked my left, I looked to my right, I looked to my left again and started to pull out as I looked right one more time. And so he probably only saw me pulling out looking right, where I had looked left twice and didn't see anything. So I pulled out anyway. It would have been really easy in that moment for me to get wrapped up in his bullshit, right? Like that was unfair. That was a rude gesture to make. It was completely uncalled for, wildly unfair. But a mindful response is, I wonder what's going on in his day that such a small trigger was enough for him to have to, you know, respond like that. Like that, he must be in his wilderness for such a small inconvenience to cause him to be so defensive, right? Was he in danger of hitting me? No. I mildly inconvenienced him where he probably had to let off the gas for, I don't know, 100 yards. I don't know how far. I'm not good at judging distance. Okay. So, you know, developing mindfulness, it's not about making excuses for people or yourself, but it is about understanding what causes behavior, right? Where do those things stem from? And, not taking things personally, right? And I hate saying it like that because it sounds flippant or like it's an easy thing to do. And I'm sure that some of my ability yesterday to like go, that guy's must be having a bad day versus like, you know, F you, buddy. Like, you know, the old me would have been like, rah, 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 and honking my horn, like, ah, you know, like that's not fair. You're being unfair to me. His response to me has nothing to do with me. And most likely it's evidence that, you know, he's already had a bad day, right? Some evidence that, you know, he's probably already in the wilderness. So that's what I mean by mindfulness, right? That every situation has a trigger, and whether or not, you know, you need to respond to it or not depends on the situation, and you got to think your way through things, right? Versus just allowing a stimulus to cause a reaction. We're asking our horses to do that, right? It is literally what we're training our horses to do all the time. And if we can't do the same for ourselves, then we're not very credible in the process of trying to train them to do it. So anytime you feel compelled to have a reaction, right, an emotional response to a situation, find a way to at some point, you know, turn that into a learning situation, right? And it doesn't have to be in the moment, because if you're already triggered and there's stress hormones flooding your nervous system, you can't think yourself out of a stress response, right? As soon as the, you know, the adrenaline is up, the cortisol is up, stuff like that, that you have to process it on a biological level. That's another thing yoga is helping me with. Spinal manipulation. Stored trauma is often in the spine, and doing twisty, turny things can help release it, and also engages the pineal gland, which helps with mindfulness. Okay, so be mindful and train your mindfulness outside of the arena, right? Like all day long, like wonder about the world, right? What is triggering behavior, and find time to be able to process it outside of the triggered situation. And then the last thing is you got to be consistent, guys. And if you can't be consistent, like I'm in a situation where I cannot be consistent right now in my training time because of the weather, then I have to adjust my expectations accordingly, right? Knowing that, you know, Vanna has had, I don't know how many weeks off now. It's probably only been like 3 weeks, but it feels like 6 months since we rode in the arena. It just helps me to, I just need to be mindful of that and then adjust my expectations the next time we do get arena time. But understand that turning something that is currently a stressful situation into a success requires consistent training, right? Whether that's in the arena or in the paddock, or, you know, it may be something you'd like to train yourself to be better at. You have to do it consistently. I am handy with my tools because every class I took on campus, we did stuff every day to get handy with our tools. I had 36 weeks of courses of every single day. There was a component of being handy with my tools. You can't play quick draw one or two times in your life and expect that the stick becomes an extension of your arm, right? You got to play with it, do stuff with it. The you know, the same with the 45, you got to play with it on a regular basis in order for it to feel comfortable and handy to you. With horses, the consistency is both behavioral and physical, right? The more athletic the thing is that I want my horse to be able to do, the more fit they need to be. So I can't ask them to do, you know, I wouldn't ask, you know, Maxie to do flying lead changes today, because they're going to be slip changes because she's not fit. She cannot hold her core long enough to be able to do a clean flying change. She's a mature woman who spent the last 3 months with her face shoved in a bale of hay, like, basically. So, you know, it'd be an unfair request, but could she do them? Yeah. I just would have to do some consistent training, get her fit again, and then they would be available again, right? So, behavior is shaped via consistency. A bare minimum, three days a week. If you're training a new behavior, in order to make progress, bare minimum 3 days a week. It might be 10 minutes for each of those 3 days. That the length of the training session isn't as important as it is the number of days in a row, honestly, or at least every other day, that kind of thing. The more, the longer the time gap is in between training new behaviors, the more likely that, you know, you will have some regression in their understanding of what you want, right? So consistency. If you can't do that, you know, it's beyond your circumstances, like mine right now, then you just have to accept it. I don't have to be happy about it, right? Acceptance isn't the same as me putting a bow on a turd, all right? I hate it. I'm not okay with it. This sucks. I'm frustrated. And this too shall pass, right? Like when spring comes. And listen, this is fall spring. With this fun little, you know, sunshine we're getting here for the next 5-6 days, it's just a teaser. It's never safe until Easter. It's not until after Easter, then we're usually safe from snow and winter. So, you know, I got to keep that in mind too, but you got to accept your situation and then move forward from a place of acceptance. Okay. All right. That was a lot of talking on my part for like an hour. What do you guys got? Any comments, questions, confusions, or requests? Do I have any more in the chat? Bonnie says Faye is comfy in a fenced area versus an open field. Yeah, that's common. And it goes both ways. Have you ever seen video footage of when they round up Mustangs? Those horses have never seen a fence before. They don't know what it means. And they'll just bash into it, like, to their own detriment. They'll, like, bloody their noses and tear limbs and because it doesn't make any sense to them, that kind of confinement. It's absolutely devastating for them. A lot of times, not all the time, but, you know, it can be. So, yeah, that's good, though, that's, you know, for her being a domestic horse, that makes sense, right? That she's more comfortable. Julie says, if you had to choose between spending mindful, undemanding time versus exposing and expanding to develop trust, which would you choose? I think, Julie, for me, that would depend on which horse I'm playing with, and what their biggest challenge was. You know, cause, so like with Gina, trusting me is the biggest hurdle to to us making progress. So I would do expose and expand with her. I do undemanding time with her, where Kaya just came trusting me. Like, she just showed up here like, yeah, sure, mommy, whatever you do is probably okay. But anytime it's a novel thing, it's an opportunity to break that trust. So I probably would do more expose and expand with her. So I think you got to decide what's the biggest red flag in front of you right now and chip away at that thing. I think I like to tackle the biggest problem first and then go from there. Good question. What else, guys? Anything else? Comments? What's, you know, could be, you know, highlights, ahas. Yeah, Cindy, go ahead.
Here we go.
There
okay,
you go.
hi, Esther. I'm driving to work, so you might not have time for it, and I can email you, but, you know, I'm definitely kind of at the frustration level with the bucking, and it's like we have to go through the box before we get to the not box, and yeah, you know, maybe I need to walk away for a while, because I do have consistency.
Yeah.
And I'm investigating some suggestions that I've seen from trying to do research on it that I can ask you about, but it's frustrating because we're years into this.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You just got to keep sending me video and we'll just keep chipping away at it. But for me, every time I've seen what's going on, Cindy, is she loses relaxation in the transition, right? So she goes from a relaxed trot to contracting her back before she transitions into the canter. And so then that makes her buck because she can't get her body organized and it probably hurts a bit, right? So she has a combination of like conformational things, as well as like, you know, previous life experiences and a propensity towards tension. So I think that the biggest thing is we're going to have to keep working on teaching her to fall in love with relaxation and not, and, you know, help her understand that there's no reason to defend herself. She's getting defensive. And I think that a lot of times what I've seen with what goes on between the two of you is you get a nice feeling in the trot and then your brain skips ahead about three steps. And in those three steps between this nice trot and the canter, she gets tight. And so instead of retreating again and getting her relaxed again before you ask for the canter, you just keep, you know, focused on the canter. And you got to be ready at any moment to go, just kidding, right? And come back and relax the trot again. Anytime her head is high and her back is low and you ask for the canter, there's a chance that she's going to buck a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know my hands aren't the best. I really try. One suggestion that I read about was that a loose ring snapple can pinch if you don't have the most reliable hands, and that switching to something that couldn't pinch, like more of a D ring, could help. And I don't know what you thought of that.
I could see that. And I agree, right, that that there's a potential pinch point on loose ring snaffles if the bit doesn't fit right. Listen, your hands are pretty good, Cindy. Like we've worked on that and you've made a ton of improvement. I still feel like the issue is that she has a habit of doing things tight, right? She has a habit through years of conditioning of getting things done tight and being told that was good enough. And so she thinks it's the right thing to do. And so convincing her that there's a better way to get it done, that she can enjoy it, it's just been a really big struggle. I think it's worth a try. Changing the bit is not a hard thing to do. But until she changes her posture in through the transition, she's still going to have the chance of defending herself because it doesn't feel good. Right. And that's when the buck comes out.
Right. And there's the mental battle too of going, okay, she's relaxed at the trot. This is when we start thinking about the canter. I really don't want to get hurt. There's always the potential this could escalate, and that stuff's going through my mind, which makes me feel tense. And
yep,
you know, so it's a whole thing.
Yes, yeah, but the big thing I really really want to keep impress upon you, Cindy, is your head gets in a spot where you start thinking about the canter, and then it's like you feel like you have to do it. You don't. Like, you can think about the canter, feel her get tight, and go, just kidding, come back to just relaxing the trot again. Where, you know, oftentimes I can see the switch in your face in your video. Like, yep, we're cantering now. And no matter, you know, and then she starts to get tail swishy and her back gets tight, and you just go ahead and ask for the canter. Where as soon as her back gets tight, you got to relax it again. You can't, you know, keep going on the canter part. We don't do tight. We have to convince her that she'll enjoy it if she can do it relaxed.
Yeah, we'll keep working on it.
Okay. I'm here for you. Keep sending me video. I know it's really hard. I feel your pain, especially because I have one who thinks that cantering is hard too. But it's getting better. Bonnie says that she's heard the same thing about the D-ring just to make sure that she's not hurting Ruby yet. Yeah. Listen, a well-fitted loose ring snaffle will not pinch. A poorly fitted one will pinch. So, you know, if the mouthpiece is the right size for their mouth, you know, then there's a tiny bit of mouthpiece beyond the corners of their mouth and the slide of the ring won't grab skin. But if it's a little bit too small, then the slide of the ring will grab skin. And of course that would be, you know, a stress trigger for some horses, especially our sensitive mares, right? Our opinionated sensitive mares will be grumpy about that and not at all inclined to, you know, put up with it. So yeah, I mean, like I told you, when I was going through my Rolodex with Vanna, I for sure tried different bridles. I tried different bits and, even, you know, different things with my cradle bridle and, you know, definitely worth experimenting with. Anything else, guys? Good stuff. All right. Thank you for being here today. I appreciate your presence. And let's do it again next week, okay? Thanks, guys. Have a great day. Talk to you again soon. Bye. Email me. Send me video.